This is Dan Modlin. Along with Dave Scott and a dedicated and talented group of friends, we released an album on 700 West Records in 1976. That album, The Train Don't Stop Here Anymore, has become popular with collectors in many parts of the world. I had a chance to sit down and talk recently with Dave Scott and the mastermind of 700 West Recording, Mo Whittemore. I asked Mo what it was about 700 West that seemed to bring out the best in so many musicians.
Gee whiz, I know what you mean, because now I listen to this stuff, 30 years after the fact, and wow, every one of these things is pretty decent, even when it was just like four channels. Yeah. Just be honest with what you do. Try to get, a decent instrumental sound. Once in a while you had to mention to the group leader that it's kind of cluttered here. Do you think one of these guys could back off a little bit and come in later doing something? Stuff like that, just leave it open. One thing you might notice is we didn't use much reverb. There's a little bit of taste, which, once you started doing country gospel or something, yeah, they wanted, to sound like God in heaven coming down on you. Just a wash in reverb. But in time, we were even able to talk those people out of using so much just for the clarity. And you had to be a diplomat. Didn't want to insult anybody. If it really stunk, you'd say, you look for the good in it and say, hey, try doing more of this and try it again from the top. And nobody seemed to get mad. And they were glad after they heard it the second time. Yeah.
Mo, you used a sense of humor very effectively. Why was that so important?
Yeah, especially screwing up people's lyrics and song titles, Yeah, most groups got a kick out of it. Some of them, their shit was sacred, And one of them that, believe it or not, one of them that didn't like that kind of thing being done to his tunes was the Sequoia group. Yeah, the Mobleys, Tom Mobley. Mainly Tom. Dan was okay. Yeah, and again, most of the time it had to do with twisted lyrics, and that always got it going.
Now, you had a pretty good idea when groups came out to 700 West, what you needed to do in terms of mic placement and some tips on how to get the best sound out of that group, didn't you?
Yeah, and we were blessed in that most of the groups are into minimum instrumentation to lay rhythm tracks and then overdub their stuff later. That way you could keep, in this small an area, some reasonable isolation, so that the instruments didn't mash into each other and bleed in. You get guitar coming from 15 feet away into drum mics, that type of thing. And that gives it kind of a garage sound, which we tried to avoid like crazy. But yeah, we had the usual blinders, gobos, whatever you want to call them, that we could put in between. We'd usually have a vocalist sing off the main mics to keep the groove going, to let guys know where they were in the tune, but not actually recording the vocal at that time. And save that for later, because a lot of people like, back then, double track the vocals and that type of thing.
Now, you're the one that taught most of us how to ping pong to get the maximum capability out of the fewest number of tracks on a recorder. How did you get started doing that?
Just to do it. Just do it and do it and do it till you get it right. I got better as time went on, when to punch in and that type of thing. Yeah, we could, at times, if the machine was up to it, we could probably punch in cleanly, seamlessly within a 16th note. And you couldn't tell that, oops, he did that there. Yeah. You had to be careful on the old 3M 4-tracker. There was a phenomena called adjacent channel interference. So if you're ping-ponging, like copying track 2 to track 3, that was a no-no on the 3M. You'd 2 to 4 is okay. Just leave, one of those tracks in the middle to guard against feedback. It wasn't that big a problem on the 8-channel machine. But on the old 4, it was.
But with either a 4 or an 8, you really had to plan ahead where you're going to put each track, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in the case of that last Zerfus thing I was talking about, the one that's on the CD, there is essentially 48 channels worth of information on that at any given time. And we did a lot of bouncing back and forth machine to machine. We'd do probably 5, 6 tracks on the 8-channel machine independently, copy them to in mono to one channel on the four tracker, use that as a guide, and then have them do whatever they might want, you know, let's do three or four backups, that type of thing. So you can bounce back and forth on the remaining three channels to come up with pretty dense vocal arrangements or horn section stuff, and then bounce that back to the 8-channel machine on a blank track or two, you know, that you've been saving. And to make sure that they're in alignment, what you do is play that guide track back along with the tracks that originally created it. And when it was getting close, you could hear it start swishing.
And Mo, looking back on it, you drew a lot of talented people to 700 West.
Yeah, it's a cross-section of the best in the area that come out here in all disciplines. You know, there was rock, of course, funk, light rock, folk rock, gospel, bluegrass. We started getting into that right near the end, and that was the hardest for me to do because it's a room full of people all blown at once, and if one guy screwed it up, it all had to be done again. After a while, we started talking people into doing it like we did our rock jobs, you know, do your rhythm tracks, you know, have a vocalist keep the groove going, and then come back in and overdub the critical stuff. That way they could, you know, pick and choose their solos, and some of them even started double tracking their vocals, you know, on a bluegrass gig, and that was neat.
Well, the reputation of 700 West has lived on for decades now. What do you hope people remember about it?
That we were fair with them, that we did a good job, reasonable price. A lot of times I gave away hours of time for them just to set up. I wouldn't really start charging until they're ready to really record the first cut, you know. Yeah, I don't know, just fair. If they got snowed in, we'd feed them, you know.
Mo Whittemore of 700 West Recording. A chance now to talk with Dave Scott. Dave, what are some of the things you remember best about recording at 700 West?
Well, I mean, I think my first impression, at least to me, was just simply that long lane. You know, it was out in the middle of nowhere. Of course, a lot of the housing and stuff that's grown up now wasn't there. You know, you're out in the country, and there's this little narrow gap in the hedgerow, you know, and you turn into the driveway, and there's this big long lane going back to some, it just looked like some regular old farmhouse, regular old Midwestern farmhouse. You know, it was really interesting because at the same time, you knew the quality of the stuff that was coming out of there because you'd heard some of it, and yet it wasn't sophisticated looking. It was an old farmhouse. They had a barn and goats out in the yard, you know. It really was incongruous, you know, that you'd have that caliber of stuff coming out of, I don't know, I guess kind of a music from Big White, I suppose, instead of a Big Pink. But yeah, I mean, I know that was my first impression of walking into the, of course, the studio room, as you recall, was right there in the living, what would be the living room. You walked right in the front door and you were in the recording room, you know, the studio room, or the playing room, I guess. And I mean, I think it was just a lot of things that you just weren't expecting. But the proof, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the proof of the talent is in the hearing and the listening, and all you had to do was take one listen to the stuff that was being done out there, and you knew you were in the right place.
And Dave, as I recall, there were an awful lot of us that would go out there and help with each other's recording projects.
There was, I don't know, in a way it was almost like a little cadre of folks that sort of found 700 West and recognized it for the quality facility that it was, and just enjoyed, not only enjoyed playing, but enjoyed working with Mo and working at the studio. And so, you know, it was not uncommon, as I recall, to have any combination of the same kind of players sometimes on a half a dozen different projects. And, you know, it was a very open, Mo operated a very open kind of facility. I mean, guys would just come out and hang out, you know, and musicians. And I can remember, you know, I think him talking about, well, yeah, you know, player XYZ came out, he was hanging out, we got to talking about this, and I said, hey, you ought to listen to this, and so I'd play some cut for him, and he said, well, I could put a neat pick your instrument track on that, and so all of a sudden they'd be breaking, and it was very impromptu, but a lot of neat stuff went on, and I think a lot of guys just, you know, really respected the genius that Mo was, and the quality of the stuff that he turned out, and loved to play anyway. And what better way to do it than to contribute to some of the projects that he was doing out there? I mean, we had some on our album. We had some guys that we were able to sort of borrow for different stuff. And as I recall, we even reciprocated, you know, a couple of times on for backup vocals and different stuff that that we played on. I think you played maybe bass on some stuff. So, you know, it was all just kind of a, I don't know, I don't want to say cooperative. That sounds too hippie-ish, but in a sense, it kind of was a music cooperative in as much as everybody was just interested in producing great stuff and was more than willing to play or whatever on anybody else's stuff if it would help help the end product.
Dave, as you look back at our album and also the other albums that were produced at 700 West, it's really kind of amazing the collectability of the product and also the ongoing interest in some of these records.
No hit record, no hit single off the album, no major label to promote you or support you or do any kind of promotion for you, and still to find that 30 years later, there are still people interested in hearing that music and sometimes even owning that music. And to see that it generally has the reputation of being considered, even at this remove, a very good piece of work. And so, you know, it's humbling in a sense, and certainly was a better reception than I ever anticipated at this length of time. And certainly I would have to say, despite the fact that we got some very good reviews and we got some airplay at the time, frankly, probably more attention to it now than it was when it was released. You know, that's rewarding and humbling and curious at the same time.
And of course, Mo was so good with the gear. I remember the first time we recorded Loser Lover in the studio, and Jerry Durham, of course, put that harmony on there. We had the three-part harmony, and the first time I really heard that in a studio, it was amazing to me.
Oh, yeah, no question. And doubling a vocal. I mean, that was amazing. I mean, you'd heard it before. I mean, you know, if you listen to me, I know to date ourselves, but, you know, if you listen to, like, the old Ricky Nelson singles and Gary Lewis and the Playboys and guys like that, you know, you could tell there was just something different about the vocals. They were thick and they were fat, and of course, you later understood they were doubled, you know, or triple-tracked, whatever it might be. But the first time you actually do it and hear yourself sound that way, it's amazing. You know, it's amazing. And just listen to the various things that Mo could do. Incredibly too, realizing that a lot of the technical wizardry that he was able to bring to the party was stuff that he'd built himself. Well, yeah, I threw together this widget and it does these bizarre things. Oh, check this. And he would laugh but it was cool. You know, it was cool. And some things were appropriate for the genre of music we were doing, and some things were probably a little less than appropriate, but that's okay. I mean, it shows the creative side that he was always looking for some way to push the envelope.
And I think it's safe to say that recording with Mo out at 700 West was an experience we'll never forget.
Because it really isn't like anything else that I've experienced. It was just a very open, comfortable facility. I think probably more so because it was just in somebody's farmhouse than it would have been if it was in a sterile environment, you know. But you'd have the kids running in and having to give Mo a kiss before Betty could put him in bed for the night, and you could smell things cooking in the kitchen, and those kind of things. So I think in that sense it was a lot more relaxed than if it had been a commercial studio someplace. It was very homey. You were made to feel very comfortable. It was very creative. Every idea was considered. And I don't know, you know, there was just kind of a magic to it.